Guys, I'm Kristen and this is Carla.
Hi.
Join us as we explore origin stories and fun facts or something. Okay. We hate technology. This is going to be the opening thing to every single episode we do from going forward.
Yes. Well, because people need to know that we are trying so hard to get a nice clean sound. We're trying because we know it matters to people and to even to our own yeah. ears when we're editing. And like, it's just really hard.
Life
like,
is so hard. Also, I just discovered that I have this like bobby pin that's sticking out of my hair. Oh, there, it came out. I felt my head and I was like, what is happening?
What do you need for bobby pins?
What do you mean?
I didn't need to use my hair wrench.
Oh my gosh, remember in university we did that mythology class and there was that one character, a cyclops or something, that uses... His line was like, so I use a pitchfork as a hairbrush, what of it? Or something.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
It was classic.
What of what it? That of became it. Like our... I like how we established so many times with this recording business to keep our mics kind of like away and keep the volume down.
Yeah.
And here I am pulling the mic closer to me. Screaming, like, settle down.
I know, I was like leaning in and just yelling into my mic, remember?
You're like Homer when he screams into the like baby stroller.
Yeah, <what's that? laughs> Oh my gosh. Okay,
oh, man.
So I have a very exciting topic this week and it's super long, so I think I should just jump into it. Otherwise, it's going to be really painful for everybody involved.
I'm fine, I guess.
How are you, Carla?
I'm fine, I told you. Let's go.
We're just going to have a real passive-aggressive, like, feel to this whole episode. It's going to be great.
Yeah, we'll just be, like, tense and just vibrating with, like, your teeth gritted the whole time.
Yeah.
Will this recording work? If not, you guys are all going to listen and
we're
going to
go on like
it.
A 6-month hiatus and just cry for a full 6 months straight.
Probably.
And then hire an engineer on the like 6 months and 1 day. I don't know.
Right?
I was going to make some like Bible joke like on the 7th day, but then I realized I hadn't set it up.
Oh, good Lord. Oh, man.
Okay. So this week, I am doing the origin of forensic science. Ooh.
What? Did you, like, binge Forensic Files? Is that where this came from?
I always binge Forensic Files. But that isn't where this came from, actually. I'll tell you at the very end what kind of prompted
what?
My thing. Yeah, you have to wait till the end. Sucker!
Oh.
When the hosts don't even want to be on the podcast anymore. What? You mean I have to pay attention the whole time?
I'm out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so what is forensic science?
Wait.
What? Am I
No,
screaming?
This is really important.
Uh-huh.
I might have mentioned this before, but you guys, my mother is so sweet. She knit me a pair of socks.
What?
You guys, it's like a walking massage on your feet. So if you know how to knit yourself some socks because it's the best feeling in the world.
Those look pretty fancy. Did you literally just take it off your foot right now?
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate ADD.
Sorry, I need
those
some
are pretty
preamble,
fancy.
All right?
But you know every time you show me Thanks. Something that your mom knits you that I want. A pair, like I want whatever it is that you get.
True. Oh, you should see what she knit for you.
Oh my gosh,
it's so
I
nice.
Can't
I'm jealous.
Wait, in a couple of weeks, I'm gonna see mm-hmm. you guys. I'm so excited.
And then you guys are going to have to, like, listen to us trying to record in the same room.
Yeah.
This is going to be
groundbreaking. We're going to, like, do the first recording together. So we'll just be swearing at technology in the same room.
In theory, it's supposed to be easier. Yeah. Right? And I bet you it's going to be a nightmare. Our computers are just going to, like, catch on fire. And, like...
yeah, they're just going to explode. And we'll have computer laptop shrapnel in our faces.
And they can do some forensic analysis. Exactly.
And they'll have this. This podcast is proof of what happened. They predicted that. Right? It's amazing.
But they don't even bother to listen. I'm not listening to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it sounds terrible.
They have some metal in their face.
That audio is awful. I'm not listening to that garbage.
Oh, God. Don't make me cry.
Okay, so I've mentioned it before on the podcast that I'm, like, obsessed with true crime stuff, which, like, these days isn't anything new, but back in the day it was, like, super weird if you told people that you liked watching stuff about murders. Forensic Files is, like, the best show ever if you just need, like, easy binging. It's so old school, so it's hilarious because they're talking about, like, these new advancements in, like, computers or whatever. It's so funny.
Enhanced.
Yeah.
By 200%.
Okay, so what is forensic science? So in a nutshell, forensic science is the application of scientific methods and principles to questions of law. So basically, forensic science is a discipline used by an investigator to solve crimes. Forensics is a really broad field, and it pulls from many different scientific disciplines. So in this, I'm going to do, like, a little overview of some fun forensic stuff. And then I kind of, like, just found information, fun little tidbits about, like, a few different aspects of forensics. Like, because it's such a huge undertaking. And I was like, I don't want to know all this crap. I just want to know, like, the fun little things.
So is forensics, like, just... like, for crimes? Is that the only time you'd ever use that term?
No. So, it's also, part of the definition, or one of the definitions of, like, the modern forensic term is, like, an argumentative, like, a debate almost kind of thing, like, that you can do a forensic thing. But primarily now, I think the way we use it now is usually not even connected to crimes necessarily, but connected to, like, trying to figure out, like, to solve something, right? Where you're, like, okay. Like, there's forensic accounting, like, ancient... for example.
Is there, like, forensic, like, archaeological forensic stuff or something? Like, do you think,
probably,
like...
but I think it is to, like, to solve something, to, like, figure something out. So it's not just, like, investigation, because that would just be...
thinking of that, like...
Oh, go ahead. What?
Yeah. I was just thinking of that skull they found, like, it was, like,
right, like, the first,
was, like,
murder. The first murder. Yeah.
Yeah,
well, that's, like, that could be, because I'm sure it's, like, the stupid TV show Bones, where, like, that's what they do, right? They figure it out from the bones, so.
Oh, yeah. You know, I enjoyed that
TV
show.
TV never lies to
I
us.
I hated it.
I hated it so much, but I also really loved it. I watched the entire thing.
Me too.
But man, was it irritating.
Yeah.
Although that's my relationship with most TV shows, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Why do I watch TV? Okay. So talking about forensics, so the word forensic derives from the Latin adjective forensis, meaning of or before the forum. What I wrote down here is that it derives from the Latin adjective forensic. I'm like, that's a typo. My autocorrect corrected it. So in ancient Rome, a criminal charge meant that the case would be presented before a group of public individuals in the forum. So that's why it's, like, has to do with the forum, right?
From that court martial?
Yeah, thing? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Both the person accused of the crime and the accuser would give speeches based on their side of the story. The individual with the best argument and delivery would determine the outcome of the case. So basically, the person with the sharpest forensic skills would win. So this origin is the source of the two modern usages of the word forensic. So as a form of legal evidence and as a category of public presentation.
Oh.
Yeah. So, fun fact, In 1659, Merriam-Webster Dictionary officially recognized and printed the word forensic. The term has been used in medical writings, or the term had been used in medical writings for many years before this, but until then it was not considered to be an official word in the English language.
What?
So, like, 1659, Merriam-Webster's Dictionary, this made me want to, like, look into whenever the hell Merriam-Webster's Dictionary was created.
Ooh.
But then I was like, that's a whole different episode. But, like, 1659, that's insane. I would never have thought it would be that early.
Oh, just super quick, because I won't, there's no topic around it. Like, I can't actually do this. My nephew wondered where the word we came from. Like, we, like when you go down the slide, like why we say it and that kind of thing. And there's nothing. It's just, a, you know, it goes back, I think, again, to like around the 1600s, 1700s, like when it was actually used. And there's nothing. And other cultures have just slight variations of it. But I was like, and I'm like, oh, it's something I'll never really have a satisfying answer for, where it's like, why? Is that the, like, fun sound we make when you go down a slide? Wee!
Yeah, because it's not, like, a natural sound
for us.
It's just
French?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, maybe. No. Anyway, sorry.
Okay, in ancient times, the manner of death was generally assumed based on where and how the victim had been found. For example, if someone was found in a body of water, they would assume that that person had drowned. Like, if they, you know... They just kind of, like, looked at it and thought they must have drowned. So suspicion of motive and hearsay took precedence over facts.
He's covered in arrows.
Yeah, but he's in the water, so he must have drowned.
Yeah.
Pretty much. So they usually, like, they based so much of their, like, criminal prosecution on, like, what other people said. So if somebody, Salem witch trials is perfect example of that, right?
Right.
Where it's like, oh, if someone didn't like that one lady, it's like, oh, she's a witch. She pissed me off. She stole something from me, whatever, right? Like,
yeah,
they could do that a lot more easily back then. I mean, they still do it now. Let's be fair. But
yeah.
Okay. So some historians regard a guy named Imhotep as the first medico-legal expert from 2650 to 2600 BC.
What?
He was both the chief justice and the personal physician to the ancient Egyptian pharaoh Zoser.
Hey, I think I remember that name. Wow.
In ancient Egypt, they had juridical inquiries and post-mortem examinations for some unexpected deaths that happened to higher level people in society.
No.
So, like, that's, like, the very earliest kinds of stuff happening. It wasn't super, like, nothing was really written down about it. Like, it wasn't an official kind of thing. But, and it was only for the high-level people.
Right, yeah. That seems so early.
I know, it does, right?
Yeah.
So, all of the...
But I guess they were in those old movies, it was like, oh, the king, I did an autopsy. It was poisoned because his whole body was black or whatever.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All of the examinations and stuff that happened in these ancient times were kind of random and usually only used when high-profile people died suspiciously. Because the rulers in ancient times were often regarded as divinities or being close to the gods, they were the ones that would typically pronounce judgments in cases of suspicious deaths. So they would be the ones that would say, that guy did it, whatever, right? As societies grew, the task devolved to trusted royal assistants and then eventually to lower officials. So these lower officials obviously did not have any divine insight or anything like that they could like quote unquote rely on. So they sought the truth more than the rulers had previously. So throughout history, the pursuit of truth in forensic matters becomes more and more structured as we go on, which I thought was like a really interesting progression of like, oh, obviously that's how it happened because they, you know, they needed to figure out the truth a little bit more. They couldn't just be a king who's sitting there saying like, God told me. Okay, so the first institutionalization of death investigation appears to have been in ancient where?
Greece.
No. Wrong. No. China.
Oh, for the love of. There's like three ancient places we cover, and I just... Ugh. Oh, yeah. They probably have like such a like huge medical kind of traditions and histories.
Yeah,
right?
They have like some really interesting stuff. So the first textbook on medico-legal death investigation was the... Oh, I'm not going to even try to pronounce it in whatever version of Chinese, like Cantonese. I don't know if that's what that is. But
yeah.
So it's translated to The Washing Away of Wrongs. That's the name of it. Isn't that so cool? I love it.
What?
By Sung Tzu, or he's also known as Song Chi. So he goes by two different names. But the...
Sorry, when was this
again? This was in... I haven't said yet. Oh, it was printed in 1247.
Whoa. Yeah.
So it was also... The book was also known as The Collected Cases of Injustice Rectified. So Song Tzu... he's considered to be the founding father of forensic science in China and largely, I think, in the world, but specifically in China.
Right.
And he wrote this text to help bureaucrats navigate the complex inquest process, provide instructions on how to examine a corpse, and determine the cause of death in these investigations. So this textbook was a manual for judicial investigators on how to conduct medico-legal death investigations. And it predates the earliest European texts on this subject by hundreds of years.
Dang!
Isn't that crazy?
I mean, maybe because there was so much... Well, no, there were like... There was always like political royal sabotage and everything, like, no matter in any place in the world, right? So it's kind of like... But wow, that's neat.
I just love the name of that book. That's so cool. The Washing Way of Wrongs.
Me too.
Okay.
It was just a how-to book on like how to get away
with basically, stuff. Yeah. Or money laundering. So by the time that this book was written, China had already been conducting forensic assessments for violent or suspicious deaths for centuries. So they'd already been doing this for a while. So back in the Qin Dynasty, which was 221 to 207 BCE, the government had started ordering forensic investigations in hanging deaths. Yeah, weird. I don't know why. And in 995 CE, or AD, whatever, a decree was issued to establish an inquest system for homicides, unusual deaths, and serious injuries. So they were like making it official pretty fast. At this time, it was bureaucrats, not full-time detectives or forensic scientists, who were responsible for leading these inquests. So they're just like these government official guys, right? There were people kind of like modern-day coroners who would examine the corpse during an inquest. But because they were not government officials, there was a general mistrust of these people. So they were like the medical people who were actually doing like cutting the like doing the invest like the examinations, but because they weren't part of the government, they were like, "Well, we can't really trust these guys." So the bureaucrats were tasked with confirming the findings of a coroner during an autopsy, and this is why the textbook was written, so that they could have a step-by-step guide for the bureaucrats to follow. It wasn't for the, like, the medical people. It was so the bureaucrats could understand the medical side of it. And they could, like, have a step-by-step guide to go through the process.
Okay.
So it would help them to indicate the specific wound responsible for death, differentiate between accidental and deliberate deaths, and distinguish between peri- and post-mortem wounds. It even described how to distinguish a real suicide from a homicide staged as a suicide. Isn't that crazy for all that stuff to be in such an early time?
Man.
It's nuts.
I mean, to be fair, like, if you think back, like, to super ancient times, like, people were full on killing each other, and there were all those kind of, like, mysterious whatnots, like, happenings, right? Like, oh, what happened to, like, the queen? Or, like, but, like,
totally.
ancient, right? Like, So I guess it makes sense. It's just
I think it's just an interesting thing because like people like that they actually cared enough to figure some of that stuff out. Like I get it with the high level people, but also to a certain degree, it's like everybody knows why that guy was that king was killed because the like his son wanted to take over. Like they usually kind of had an idea of who did it anyway. Like right.
So why yeah like it's. Why the need for all these like the mystery solvers?
Yeah,
almost,
yeah.
Right? Like, dang. Well, I guess people were like trying to get away with things since, but that's insane. Like that we were homicidal right from the
beginning.
Yeah,
basically, exactly. So I mentioned that they were doing autopsies in there and that it had like a step by step guide for them. So now I'm gonna go into autopsies and like a little bit of the history of what like the autopsies and when they kind of started. So, okay. Egyptians were the first to perform autopsies in 3000 BC. These weren't official autopsies as we know them now, though. They were a part of the mummification okay. practice. So, during that, like, the process, they removed and examined the internal organs of humans after their death. So, that's considered to be, like, mm-hmm. the earliest form, like, of an autopsy in a way.
Okay.
The first officially recorded autopsy was performed in 44 BC, and it was in relation to a super famous murder.
Oh, the guy!
Yeah, it was a guy.
I was trying to remember.
This autopsy was performed by a Roman physician named Antistius. And he examined the body of a certain Roman politician and general named Julius Caesar. The autopsy revealed that although Caesar was stabbed 23 times, only one of the wounds was fatal. So he died from a single wound in his chest, although he was stabbed like way more.
You know, I'm so brain dead today that I was thinking of the guy, that what was his name? Otzi or something? The guy that was supposedly
that
like,
Iceman, the tattoo
guy?
The
first murdered guy. Well, the Iceman.
Yeah,
guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy. And I'm like, no, that's not when he was from. And nobody performed an autopsy on him. Like, I am so
I thought it was
stupid.
So cool, the Julius Caesar thing. I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. For some reason, I always kind of think it was like fake because it was, I don't know, written about in plays and stuff. Like, no, that actually happened. Okay, in the 3rd century BC, this guy Erasistratus and Herophilus performed the first autopsies in Alexandria. In the 2nd century AD, Galen, who was the physician to Roman gladiators, dissects both animals and humans to search for the causes of disease. In 1194, King Richard Plantagenet?
I guess
yeah,
Plantagenet?
Which I didn't know. I was like, that doesn't look right. You know, when you see research and you're like, that's not real. So I actually had to Google who this guy was. I'm like, oh, it's Richard III.
Oh, darn it.
Duh.
Yeah. I'm like, why do I remember? I'm like, yeah, it's like the
Like, for some
thing.
Reason,
like,
that last name has like never factored into like my realm of understanding at all.
I was obsessed with Richard III, so that's why it's sort of ringing a bell now. I'm just like, oh.
So King Richard III officially creates the position of coroner in 1194. In the 1200s, the first forensic autopsies are done at the University of Bologna? Mortadella? No. Salami?
Yeah, I never know if it's Bologna or just Bologna.
I know.
I think
it's
Bologna.
Bologna. I don't know. It's definitely not Bologna.
Anyway.
And then we've got 1247, the washing away of wrongs was the first forensic text that was created, which I talked about already. In 1276, so almost 30 years later, De Officia Coronatoris, which describes the coroner's duties, is published in England. So you can see that, like, more places in this time are, like, focusing on this.
Yeah.
Around 1350, Pope Clement VI orders autopsies on victims of the Black Death to hopefully find a cause for the plague.
Ooh.
In the 16th century, Italian surgeons were laying the foundation of modern pathology by studying the changes in the structure of the body due to a disease. So they were kind of like doing some of that, like they were having an interest in that stuff so that when someone died, you could see, like you could tell kind of what it was from. 1642, yeah. The University of Leipzig offers the first courses in forensic medicine. 1642, that's so early, I find. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Okay, so that was autopsies. Now I'm going to talk about fingerprints. Ooh.
I want to guess. They came up with it right after the Reaper guy. Street Reaper.
Jack the Ripper? Otherwise known as Street Reaper.
You guys, my brain isn't working. Street Reaper. Good
no.
God.
No, you're wrong. I was going to try to be like, spin it and say something all nice. Right. I'm like, kind of, but I don't think so.
No.
I mean, it could be. Like, Jack the Ripper was like a big kind of thing for a lot of it was like photography in crime scenes, which I didn't end up doing like a thing on it. But they talk a lot about that where like they would take pictures of the victims and all that kind of stuff.
Street Reaper.
That's good. Oh, God. Okay, so fingerprints in 200.
Wait, can I just say how nice it is that you knew what I was talking about, though? It's like, thank you.
In 200 BC, the Babylonians used fingerprints to sign contracts. But it doesn't appear... I know, right? Isn't that crazy? But it doesn't appear that they used them to solve crimes at that time. But they were aware that fingerprints were kind of a way to, like, identify yourself, in a sense, right? Hmm. So around 1000 AD... Roman attorney Quintilian shows that a bloody handprint was intended to frame a blind man for his mother's murder. It's like a really famous case where they're like, he actually like got this guy free because he used this bloody handprint. So it's like one of the early ways that they used forensics in an actual case. In 1686, an Italian professor named Malpighi noted that fingerprints have different characteristics. So he was like, oh, they've got these whorls and loops in them. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until 1892 that Francis Galton developed a way of classifying fingerprints for filing, which is still in use today. There are other fingerprint things, but like his stuff is used still. He conducted a bunch of statistical research into the likelihood of two people having the same sets of fingerprints, and then he started categorizing the different types of patterns into broad classifications. So these classifications were the plain arch, the tented arch, the simple loop, the central pocket loop, weird, the double loop, the lateral pocket loop, the plain whorl, and the accidental. Just the accidental.
Oh my gosh.
He published the first book on fingerprints and their use in solving crimes. So fun fact, he was the cousin of Charles Darwin.
Yeah. What?
Not so fun.
So the guy who wrote the first book on like just the basically crime fingerprints.
Was the cousin of Charles Darwin.
Was related to Charles. That's crazy.
What's also crazy and not such a fun fact was that he was also the inventor of eugenics, a pseudoscience used by terrible people to justify genocide and terrible treatment of certain groups of people.
Oh, brother.
I know. Apparently, a lot of his experimenting with fingerprints and other physical stuff was done because he was hoping to tie personal and intellectual characteristics to physical traits and heredity. So he basically was trying to prove that, like, white people are better than everybody else. In his book titled Fingerprints, real original title, He wrote, quote, "It seemed reasonable to expect to find racial differences in finger marks. The inquiries were continued in varied ways until hard fact had made hope no longer justifiable." So, essentially, he wasn't able to find a link between any of that stuff.
Right.
So, terrible guy invented a pretty interesting tool used to investigate crimes. Or did he? Dun, dun, dun. Turns out that he's just an all-around loser, because it seems that he stole the fingerprinting idea from other researchers and took full credit for it. So in 1880, over a decade before Galton's, quote, discovery, Dr. Henry Faulds published an article that predicted the forensic usefulness of fingerprinting. He referenced the work of Sir William James Herschel, who had been using fingerprinting in India as a way to battle signature forgery. So kind of the same as like the old part where they'd have them put their fingerprints down. Faulds added to Herschel's work with his own experiences with law enforcement in Japan, and he proposed fingerprinting as a serious investigative tool. Apparently, he experimented with seeing if fingerprints remained the same or if they changed over time or if they changed in different circumstances. So he actually got a bunch of volunteers and would use like pumice stone, sandpaper, and even acids like on their fingerprints to see if the fingerprints would appear differently after new skin growth. But they kept appearing the same exact way. The fingerprints stayed the same. And so he like figured out, and then he found out.
Wait, so how do people, but if they burn their things, then...
Yeah, like, I think there are like ways to, gone, like, get it completely gone, but he wasn't doing that to people. He was just damaging a little bit, like, just kind of injuring their fingers a little bit.
Like acid.
So Dr. Faulds then sought out Charles Darwin to help further the research, who then passed the information on to his cousin, Galton. Galton took that research and never credited Faulds or Herschel for their contributions, and the three men feuded for decades.
Of course.
So, although maybe, so it might turn out that they could have all been thieves of this research, because apparently in 1788, Dr. Nathaniel Grew published an illustrated anatomy book in which he claimed that, quote, "The arrangement of skin ridges is never duplicated in two persons." So they're all working on the same thing at the same time. It's kind of a collaborative thing, like all of the scientific stuff, I think, tends to be. But some of the earlier guys were giving credit to each other because they were working on it kind of at the same time and like sharing information. Mm-hmm. But Galton never did that. And he's just a dick because he's
so
eugenics.
Is it actually true that like no one like you no one would have like the same fingerprints?
I know, right?
How?
That's a question for another day.
Well, because like aren't snowflakes like didn't somebody say that there could be the same snowflake?
Yeah, I mean, how would we know?
Like, how would we know? Yeah.
But yeah, like there, as far as they could tell, there weren't any two people that had the same ones. Like, there were always some kind of variation in them, right?
Right. I guess with the whole probability, like, you know how they're like, how many variations? And there's like, you know, 80 billion. But I was just like, are there enough people on the planet now that we have had them? But then, even if they did match, I bet it would be from, like, a dead person from, like, 8 million years ago anyway.
Just recycled fingerprint from some dead guy. Mm-hmm. And that was fingerprinting. Okay, physical evidence is a super short one. I just included it because it was a really fun little anecdote. In 1784, an Englishman was convicted of murder when a torn piece of newspaper that held the murder weapon matched a piece of newspaper found in his pocket. And this was the first documented use of physical evidence. Yeah,
no.
For like a conviction. Cool, hey?
Ooh.
Okay, now we get into blood and toxicology. In 1775, Carl Scheele realized he could...
Hey, I know
Carl Scheele?
Yeah, I swear I mentioned it somewhere. Anyway, continue. Cool. Yeah.
He realized he could transform arsenious oxide into arsenious acid, which, when combined... Yeah! Oh! The pigment thing?
I think the pigment thing, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. When combined with zinc, produced arsine or arsine. So why is this important? Because this discovery led to the eventual ability to detect arsenic poisoning. And it probably created some kind of pigment that people rubbed all over their bodies until they died. So modern toxicology began in 1813 when Mathieu Orfila developed tests for the presence of blood and used a microscope to investigate blood and bodily fluids. He is considered to...
Sorry, I reacted so strong on my head to microscope. Microscope!
Oh my gosh, like, I was going to go into a whole thing about like the origin of the microscope because it kept popping up. I'm like, damn it, no! So much of the stuff in this, I'm like doing the most surface level thing. And I just picked stuff that popped out to me as like interesting. Good, because I could go down like 7 million rabbit holes on the beginning of every single one of these things. It's crazy.
If somebody listens to this and they get excited about a topic, like I want them to go and like actually do, you know, deeper research and write. Like don't
take my word for it.
Listen and run kind of thing. Well,
so Orfila is considered to be the father of toxicology after he published a book about different poisons and their traits. Like, he published a whole book about it.
Wait, I said that wrong because that sounded like a bash, an insult to you. I don't mean that. I meant, like, I hope that, like, people, not that I don't want it to sound like I think we do a bad job. Like, it's all surface and, like, I meant, I like the idea that it's could get someone interested about something. And then they'd be like,
well, there's no way to cover like every aspect of any topic unless you're like dedicating your life to it, right?
Yeah.
And even then.
But it's just fun thinking that you could get someone excited.
Totally. I love that. I know. Because that's how I feel with certain things when I listen to podcasts. I'm like, oh, no way. I want to like find out more about that. I don't find out more, but
yeah.
I'd like to think I would someday. In 1887, in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's first Sherlock Holmes novel called A Study in Scarlet, Holmes develops a chemical to determine whether a stain was blood or not, something that had not yet been done in real-life investigation. So a lot of people, when I looked up forensic stuff, a lot of people point to the Sherlock Holmes novels as like almost a... something that people look to prompt detectives to kind of like get more into forensics. Yeah. Obviously forensics were happening, like the sciences were developing throughout time.
Right.
But I think it was one of those things that kind of brought it into the mainstream a little bit more and made people realize like, oh, maybe we should be looking at the crime scene differently, or even the public to not be quite as dumb as they used to be of like trampling through a crime scene immediately.
If you well, if you think about it, there's like a lot of like, you know, we'll watch stuff like a lot of like science fiction stuff, and I'm sure a lot of people were inspired of like by what they see, which didn't exist yet, right? And they're like, oh, exactly, maybe I can do that, exactly, right? So cool.
In 1900, human blood groups were identified. And in 1915, a method for determining blood types was discovered, and it was used immediately.
Wait, 1915?
Yeah. It was discovered, and it was used immediately in criminal investigations. Like, it was used right away for that. Luminol was developed in 1937, and it reveals blood residue even when blood has been cleaned up.
1937. Oh my.
That's way earlier than I thought it would be. Yeah.
Me too.
Okay. Now, I didn't know who this, like, where this guy kind of fit in, but he was so cool. So I just gave him his own little section. So his name is Eugene Vidocq or Vidocq. I don't know. He's French. This guy's so cool, and I hope he's not secretly a dick. Like, I hope there's no eugenics involved or, like, terrible treatment of women or something. But, like, he is such a cool thing. So he was a career criminal in the early 1800s in France. And fun fact, not only did his
Okay.
life work have an enormous impact on the forensic sciences, but his life story influenced major writers like Edgar Allan Poe and Victor Hugo. In 1811,
Ooh.
he sw had sworn off the life of crime and decided to switch sides and help stop crime instead. He
Ooh.
founded a plainclothes investigative unit called the Brigade de la Sûreté. Using his own perspective as a former criminal, he developed the concepts of ballistics analysis, undercover investigations, and footprint analysis. But wait, that's not all. He also created the first major criminal database. He based this on the
That's
theory that many crimes were committed by reoffenders like himself. And apparently, he had a photographic memory, but he knew that he couldn't rely on his colleagues to have the same type of memory. So he implemented a system of anthropometrics that's still partially in use by French police today. After each
What?
arrest, officers would record the suspect's aliases, physical description, previous convictions, likely motive, and other relevant information, such as handwriting samples for suspected forgers and stuff like that. And they'd put it all into this database so that they could all reference these different things and see
Oh
them.
my gosh, that's
And over time,
crazy.
the information got more and more detailed and the system got more developed, obviously. And now they have easy databases that you just search for
Oh
somebody and
my
you can find
gosh.
them. But look, that so, and he had this crazy long career of like working in,
Oh my
like, to
gosh.
catch criminals and do all this stuff. It's insane. I'm like, I want to know everything about his life. He sounds so cool.
I love that you, when you started the thing, you were like, yeah, I hope he's not a dick in real life. And he's, your next, practically next sentence was, he was a career criminal. I'm like, I feel like the people he wronged would say that that counts
Okay, but compared to being the inventor of eugenics, I feel like some petty like theft is fine. I think he was I was gonna say he's just I think he was like a bank robber and like just like a petty like thief. Like I don't think he was like a rapist or anything like that. So at least
Yeah, but still,
that.
it was so funny.
I love how he wouldn't even have noticed that at all. Like, he sounds so cool. I don't care what else he did. Okay, in 1835, Henry Goddard from Scotland Yard, oh my gosh, that rhymes, was the first documented person to use bullet comparison to catch a killer. He noticed a flaw in a
Ooh.
bullet and ended up being able to trace it back to its original mold. Now we have another really cool guy that's coming up. And he, I'll tell you what he does as we go. In the early 20th, I have like a little like headline or a title for it, but I don't need it to do that. In the early 20th century, Edmond Locard became known as the French Sherlock Holmes. A lot of people like to call them the whatever Sherlock Holmes of wherever place they're from, because they're really original. So he's now credited as one of the fathers of modern forensic science. At this time in history, criminal investigations largely centered around eyewitness testimony, which we know is never accurate, and corruptly extracted confessions. So Locard had been a medical examiner in World War I, and in 1910 he rented a two-room attic in Lyon, France, and transformed it into what is considered to be the first forensic crime lab. Yeah. But it
What?
took him, I know,
Good
right? It
grief.
took him 2 years before he and the lab were able to break a major case. So in 1912, a woman was found murdered in her parents' house, and the prime suspect, her boyfriend, had a solid alibi. Four men swore that they had been playing cards with the boyfriend at the time of the murder. Locard analyzed the corpse and determined the cause of death to be strangulation. He then scraped under the boyfriend's fingernails and found a pink residue, which he identified to be women's makeup. But makeup wasn't mass-produced at the time, so he was able to trace it back to its vendor with certainty. So he knew exactly where that makeup that she had on was came from. Yeah. Locard matched the fingernail residue to the victim's beauty shop, and the boyfriend was arrested. He ended up confessing, and in his confession, he revealed that he had set the clock back an hour at the card game so that his friends could vouch for his presence at the time of the murder. Whoa!
Oh!
I know, right?
Oh, man. Back then, it must have been so easy to, like, dupe people.
Like, nobody had cell phones or, although, like, other watches that they were looking at.
To be fair, I duped my nephew because there's a clock in his little guest bedroom here that, like, isn't set to, like, the right time. So it's like he wakes up and he thinks it's, like, earlier than it is. So he's like, oh, like, I can't wake up Auntie, so I'm just going to sleep again.
Nice.
Even though he has his tablet. But now he's clued in to check his tablet and he'll check in, and now it's, like, busting my door down at 7 in the morning. And I'm like, oh, God. But it worked a couple of times.
That's hilarious. I love it.
Yeah. If you want to change the clocks.
You just change the thing on his tablet. Just sneak in and get it, like, after he's gone to sleep. That would be good. Change the time zone. So Locard is famous for his exchange principle, which states that whenever there's contact between two items, there will be an exchange of material. And that principle now forms the basis of much of forensic science.
That transfer thing.
So all the, like, even touch DNA, like, all kinds of stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, now we get on to DNA. So in 1868, Friedrich Meischer discovers DNA. 1868, that's way earlier than I thought. I know.
That's nuts. 1868? Yeah.
So, in 1953, they throughout the years, discovered a whole bunch of different things with DNA. Like, it's just like anything where they get more detailed, more and more detailed about stuff. So,
yeah.
In 1953, they discovered the unique structure of DNA. So that the double helix and all that kind of stuff. So they're realizing that people have unique, like, DNA is unique to them in some way.
Right. Isn't there, I thought I saw a program where there was a bit of a scandal where a woman actually had some part in DNA or genome stuff or whatever, but, like, none of the men gave her credit.
Probably.
But really, she was, like, this, I know, I have to investigate that again, because that's a shame if she's
But I think that happened a lot in the sciences, I feel like. Like, some of them, because when you see some women were, like pioneers at that time, too, and you're like, whoa, they let a woman through? And it's like, yeah, but I feel like they existed a lot more, and they just weren't given credit, you know?
Yeah. Or even some of the men weren't given credit.
Yeah, exactly. So 1953, they realized that everyone had unique DNA. But at that point, they couldn't tell all that much from a forensics perspective. Like, it didn't necessarily... Like, they could. Okay. They were starting to get there, but they weren't there yet. So in the mid-1980s, there was perhaps the biggest leap forward for forensic science since the analog fingerprint, and that was DNA matching. So in 1984, Sir Alec Jeffreys, a British geneticist, stumbled across the realization that DNA showed both similarities and differences between family members, making it perhaps the most accurate form of identification ever discovered. For the next 3 years, Jeffreys' laboratory was the only one in the world capable of performing DNA matching, and it received an enormous number of requests within that time frame. So in 1986, so 2 years later, Jeffreys' method was employed in a criminal case for the first time when local police were investigating the rape and murder of two women, one that occurred in 1983 and one that occurred in 1986. So blood and saliva mm-hmm. samples were collected from more than 4,000 men in the area. But the method... Yeah, I know, right? Whoa. But the method identified only one match for both crime scenes. The DNA of Colin Pitchfork. Which is a hilarious name.
That is.
Without the use of DNA matching, Pitchfork would never have been apprehended. But just as importantly, it exonerated Richard Buckland, a man who had been, up until then, the prime suspect, because he had falsely confessed. Whom authorities say would have served life in prison if not for Jeffrey's contributions to the case. Like, if not for the DNA, this other guy who had a false confession, like, whatever, he would have gone away for it, but he didn't do it. This Pitchfork guy did, which his name makes me laugh so hard. And I mean, jump forward to modern times when the Golden State Killer a few years ago was caught using familial DNA that was submitted through an Ancestry DNA company. It wasn't Ancestry.com. It was a different one. But like, that's how this massive serial killer was caught. Advancements in research of DNA profiling and blood analysis have made it possible to identify victims as well as suspects in a process commonly known as DNA fingerprinting. And there are now some places that can reconstruct an image of a person based on the DNA found at a crime scene. Yeah, so they do that like reverse thing where they can actually like create wanted signs, or in the case of a Jane or John Doe, they can actually like reconstruct what the victim probably looked like and help figure out who they are.
It's like that guy I think I mentioned in that maybe my fire episode, where he reconstructs that ancient guy. He could figure out his skin color, his hair color, eye color. And it's like, what? Side note, there have been a few reports and stories done about like those Ancestry.com type, like the thing. Be careful, everyone. It can be highly inaccurate. And it can, and it can tell you things that, like, just, like, not just inaccurate stuff, but, like, they can just be dead wrong as well. But stuff that doesn't actually, like, really, what was the thing? I think about the, like, food stuff in particular. They had this weird, like, they go into all kinds of things, right? They analyze and they give you a report where they're, like, you know, I don't know if it was, maybe it was allergens or allergies or something, or food sensitivities or intolerances. And they were like, that's garbage. Like, don't listen to it or something.
Because so there are some DNA ones that will tell you if you have, like, if you're predisposed to certain, like, illnesses and stuff like that.
Right. And those can be just misleading.
That's a bit of a slippery slope.
And wrong. Yeah. And so everyone, so don't ever look at, and even with like the actual ethnicity thing, a lot of it is inaccurate too. So like, just do your research and don't get your hopes up and don't take it.
I mean,
as
I've had genetic testing done to figure out that I have like the breast cancer gene, but they specifically tested for that specific gene, right? They knew what they were looking for.
Exactly. Yeah. No, yeah, I just mean those DNA kit, the ones that you pay and that kind of, like, because they're just the mail order whatevers, and they don't do like that kind of extensive proper testing or whatever. So
interesting. Yeah, totally.
Just
saying. Okay, now my last little blurb. I'm almost at the end, but this is the reason, this is what kind of prompted me to do this topic on forensic science.
The reason.
I know, the reason at the end, I don't think. So when I was looking up the Canadian stuff, she came up in my thing of like Canadian inventions and stuff. And so I was like, what? It's a woman in Canada at the forefront of forensic science back in the day. Ooh. So I'll just do a little blurb about her. So her name is Frances Gertrude McGill. And she was, the entire reason that sparked me to even look into this.
Is she McGill University lady?
I actually don't
know. Is that what it's
know.
Named after?
There's a lake a lake near Manitoba that's named after her, though, if that helps. I literally just looked into her, like, right before. I had her the tab of her information open for, like, ever, and then I kept going down rabbit holes of looking into everything else. So she was a Canadian forensic pathologist, criminologist, bacteriologist, and allergist. She has been nicknamed the Sherlock Holmes of Saskatchewan. She influenced the development of forensic pathology in Canadian police work and was internationally noted for her expertise on the subject. She completed her medical degree in 1915. Crazy early.
Whoa.
Maybe she was that lady in that Heritage Minutes. I wonder, actually.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna Google.
In 1920, she became the provincial pathologist for Saskatchewan, and by 1922 had become the director of the provincial lab. She worked with the RCMP and local police forces for more than 30 years and was instrumental in establishing the first RCMP forensic laboratory in Canada. Isn't that so cool? I just love that it was so early and she was a woman and she was like so influential, and she basically just kept working until she died in 1959. Like, she just kept going. It was awesome. I didn't look into anything more specific about her because I was already at 11 pages of research and I was like, there's no way I'm going to get through all of this.
Let's see here. Oh, no. I think it's... No, that was a different lady. I think.
Still. Yeah.
But still.
And that's the origin of forensic science. A very vague origin of forensic science.
Oh, my gosh. It was so interesting. And it's so crazy to note that, like, a lot of the stuff that people, like, counted or, like, was allowed in court, like, a lot of the forensic stuff has been debunked recently, you know, like, the blood splatter stuff, like, maybe not the debunked, but, like, people have...
Analysis.
Yeah, hair analysis.
What's the other one?
I think there was a major one that was kind of surprising to me. I forgot what it was, too. But, yeah, isn't that crazy? It's, like...
I know a lot of that stuff, but it just proves that, like, as science goes on, there's always going to be things changing and evolving, which is good. I mean, we should be learning and developing new stuff that's more accurate, right? Like, I don't think there's any end to that.
But maybe... And what a thing to have to, like, you know, you should be cautious going forward, right? But, like, at the same time, I hate when in medicine or science, the established people are, like, reluctant to get with the times or, like, to advance stuff. Like, I get really annoyed with them when they're like, no, that's impossible or that's dumb. But they're not thinking ahead enough, right? And so it's kind of like,
well, it's interesting that happened with every single new thing that came in. Like, when I was looking at fingerprinting, I realized that I didn't write it in here, but you know, the first cases where they were trying to convict somebody based on their fingerprints, people were fighting against it, like actively fighting it, because they were like, what is this like voodoo science kind of thing, right? Like, and same with DNA and same with the blood analysis stuff. Like, every single thing that comes in, people push against it because it's not what they know.
Oh my gosh.
And they have to, like, prove it, you know, like have all this other stuff behind it. But I think it's honestly just that.
Yeah. But then some of the garbage they do include, where they're like, oh, I'm an expert, forensic expert in this and this. But then really you look at their, I think there's a whole Netflix documentary where there was this guy who was so
pathetic. Oh, yeah.
Dental stuff, I think. Mm-hmm. Or like bite marks or something. Yeah. There was something about dental stuff that he was so off. I think it was bite marks. Yeah. He was so completely just, but he was like, oh no, I'm an expert. I know what I'm doing. And just really arrogant. And I'm just,
it's such a slippery slope, but it's also that thing of like, okay, so you won't take fingerprint evidence in, but you'll believe like Joe Schmo that was walking down the street and he has a grudge against that guy. And he says that guy for sure killed that other guy. Like, you'll trust that, but you won't trust this actual thing, right? And I get it, because it's new to them at that time. Like, I'm sure there's stuff now where we're like, oh, I don't know, I don't really trust it, you know? And in 10 years' time, it's going to be the norm. Like, there's always going to be new stuff, right? We're just reluctant to change.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Remember to like, subscribe, and review. It really helps us out. You can follow us on Instagram. We are at podcast.or.something. Or you can write to us at podcast.or.something@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And we'll talk to you later. Or something. Bye.
Bye.